started.
We are officially in the summer. I was about to start singing a song about time, and I think it was a High School Musical song, like, what time is it? But I realized I know any of the words, and maybe it's not what time is it. I'm not very versed in High School Musical, so let's just get to this episode, friends. It is time. Here's what it's time for: to shout some worth and shift some narratives for people with Down syndrome. Today, although I am solo and we will be missing very much my co-hosts Micah and Mercedes because I'm just a third of a person without them, I do have a chance to chat with Dr. Velotti, who is a pediatrician, has a brother with Down syndrome, has an incredible Down syndrome podcast. You all, this conversation will knock your socks off. So grateful for that he's here today and that you're joining us as well. Welcome to the Lucky Few podcast. This is for all the mamas in the space. Hey, mamas in the space, say hey. Do you need a respite? Yes. Yes, I do. Thank you so much for asking. Great. Well, guess what? This August, the 26th, 27th, and 28th is going to be our first ever Lucky Mamas Retreat in Southern California. It's going to be in San Diego County, hosted by myself and Liz Plakta from Ruby's Rainbow. And we are bringing our flagship Lucky Mamas Retreat to the beautiful Oaks Retreat Center in Ramona, California, which is just outside of San Diego. This is an all-inclusive retreat. You show up Friday evening. You don't have to worry about one thing until you go home Sunday. And then hopefully you still don't have to worry because you're so refreshed and ready to face the week. It's going to be such an amazing time. You're going to get to be there with other lucky mamas. We're going to get to connect, swap stories, reflect, relax. You have time on your own, time together, really whatever you want to do. We're going to feed you good food and delicious beverages. And you're going to really have an opportunity to create long-lasting friendships. Sounds amazing, right? If you would like to come to our Southern California Lucky Mamas Retreat, you can go to heatheravis.com/events, learn more, and sign up there. All right, now on to our episode. All right, y'all, here we go. We're going to get into this episode because there's just too much good stuff here to be dilly-dallying. I like to say that. And then I like to talk about things and make you, and then I like to dilly-dally. We're going to read a review. We are here for all of you listeners. That is what we are here for. And we are so thankful for the feedback because it helps us to continue to refine this podcast to be the thing that works for you because we're here for you. So thank you to everyone who leaves a review. This comes from Caroline G.I.V., Caroline Give, who says, as a mom to a young daughter who has Down syndrome, this podcast feels like home. Being newish to the special needs community, it's easy to feel isolated. I love listening and knowing that I'm not alone in this journey and that our journey is beautiful. Thank you, ladies. Caroline, thank you for sharing that. You are not alone. And we all, everyone listening, and I know I can speak for Mercedes and Micah and myself here, those feelings of isolation are real. The feeling is real. Being alone is not, because we are all here for you, even if just through a podcast. So thank you for leaving that. If you are a listener, don't forget to review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Every review helps. I mean, leave a 5-star. Let's just be honest here. If you have a 1-star, email us. Hello at the Lucky Few Podcast. We talk. But seriously, leave those reviews, because every time there's reviews left, it helps people see the podcast more. We really appreciate it. And maybe we'll read your review aloud next week. We love reading these and appreciate your support. All right, friends. Like I had said, I am here with Dr. Kishore Velotti. He is the medical director of the Down Syndrome Center at UPMC Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh. He hosts his own podcast called the Down Syndrome Center of Western Pennsylvania, which was my first Down Syndrome podcast I listened to and continues to be tied for first place as a favorite. The Lucky Few, obviously, tied with. It's such a good podcast. I hope you're listening to it. And not only does he have medical insight into Down syndrome and podcast expertise, he also has grown up with a brother who has Down syndrome. So we're going to talk some sibling talk today too. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
So glad to have you here. It's really fun. I got to do an interview with Kishore on his podcast, and it's fun to hear the voice of a podcast host you've been listening to for a long time and connect a face. I love it. Okay. So I gave a little brief introductory there. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think where everything starts for me is right. I was literally born into the Down syndrome community. My older brother, Das, is older by just about 20 months than I am. And so when I came into the world, I was in this community, and his friends growing up and even to this day are my friends. And and it never really occurred to me that he had anything different than anyone else until I got to be probably 8, 9, 10 years old. And one of my friends from school says, "Hey, what's different about your brother?" And I said, "I don't know. Aren't all brothers like this? I mean, he's always like loves to hang out and have fun with us." And we just kind of moved on. And later on in that day, I said to my mom, I said, my friend said this, and that's the first time I ever talked about Down syndrome. And so I would not advise that for parents to not necessarily talk about it until your child brings it up at 9 or 10 years of age. But that's kind of how my story began. And so I've always known I was going to do something with the Down syndrome, the population that I work with, and that knowing my brother and knowing the impact that he's had on my life, I knew I always wanted to give back to him. So I went to medical school, became a pediatrician. And sure enough, in 2009, the possibility of running the Down Syndrome Center here in Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh came up. And it took me all of 30 seconds to say yes when the question was asked. And that's kind of how it all started with the center here. And then I was able to work with the National Down Syndrome Congress for many years. And I served as their president for about 3 years. And so it's just been an awesome ride. And it all begins because of what my brother has done for me.
So cool.
Yeah.
Okay. So many questions. Let's start with your work, what you do. Yeah. Can you like walk me through a day? Are you just hanging out with patients who have Down syndrome just all day long?
It is the greatest job ever. I have residents and medical students who work with me. And when they spend a day with me in clinic, they say, "You get paid to do this?" And I said, "In fact, I do." That, as all of us who have family members with Down syndrome can say, it's usually a lot more fun to hang out with people with Down syndrome than to hang out with those who don't. And just spend an entire day where I'm getting high fives, you know, from the older ones, and getting jokes from the even older ones than that, or even just getting to hang out with the little babies. It is just a joy to be able to do what I do. And so, yeah, that's right. My clinic is essentially a clinic where we supplement the care that the primary care providers are providing. So, for example, a family practitioner or pediatrician may be seeing them and doing well child care visits, immunizations, and things like that. When they come to see me, it's really just to make sure that we're up to date with all of the healthcare guidelines when it comes to medical issues and Down syndrome. But even now, I was a little late for recording this podcast with you because we had to talk a lot about toilet training with a family. Mm-hmm. And people don't know where to go for that mm-hmm. type of information, especially when it comes to the specifics of how to do that with somebody with Down syndrome. And so that's kind of where we come in, is just kind of catching all of those other areas that may not be able to be caught by a primary care doctor.
Are you working with all ages, like birth all the way?
All ages. So yeah, so we start prenatally in our clinic.
Oh yeah.
So we'll meet with moms at that prenatal stage. We'll also, of course, newborn visits. And then until they're about 14, usually I see them. And then from 14 to 18, I have a colleague who is trained in both internal medicine and pediatrics. Mm-hmm. So he does a transition clinic. So he gets them ready when they're teenagers, gets them ready for adult care. And then we have two adult providers who take over from 18 all the way through adulthood. So we have a lifespan care, which is really, really rare. But we have that here in Pittsburgh.
Wow. What a gift for your families. That's incredible. That's incredible. Really, maybe we'll move to Pittsburgh. I'm not.
But it's not a bad place to be.
I think it's lovely. I'm just a California girl. I don't know how I would do. But that, what a great service to offer. And my hope is that more and more clinics like that open up all over, because there is such a need for it. And it's such an incredible service to give to families who have a loved one with Down syndrome. as someone in the medical field, how have you seen things medically in the field change for Down syndrome? And even going back, if you have thoughts and memories about your brother, yeah. All the way to since you've been medical professional and where we're at now.
I mean, there has been such tremendous change in the years, even since my being alive. But I mean, if we think about the 1940s and 50s, it was just thought that if you had a child with Down syndrome, that they had an option most of the time that was, I think, taken, that they didn't live within the family setting. And so moving into institutions and things of that nature was kind of the expectation back then, which is so sad. And we think about life expectancy back in those days for somebody with Down syndrome, there was no medical care. If you had a heart issue, you weren't going to get it fixed. And so life expectancy was like 15. I mean, it was terrible from a medical perspective. And it was just kind of one of those things in that era where doctors would just say, that's just the life expectancy of someone with Down syndrome. And it was not, there was no expectation for better. And then in the 80s, really, it was families, parents who really were like, this is wrong. And we need to offer the same medical care for somebody with Down syndrome as we would for anybody else, including intestinal repairs if they needed it, or cardiac repairs if they needed it. And wouldn't you know that life expectancy has grown so dramatically that even now, this current era, which doesn't even include people with great medical options, you know, 30, you know, 40, 50 years ago, they're living until early 60s. And that number is only going to, I think, continue to climb as we see this era of providing medical care as would be expected for anybody, providing it to somebody with Down syndrome. That number is only going to get later and later as we see people being able to get their medical conditions treated like they should. If they need something treated, they should have it treated. And so that to me has been the biggest change. And in fact, my colleague who works on the adult side always often says, if you took the life expectancy change from 1970 until now for the people with Down syndrome and you applied it to people who don't have Down syndrome, we'd all be living to 300. Wow. I mean, that's how dramatic the change has been. And it's really an amazing thing that is an unfortunate commentary on medicine in general that we didn't realize this was possible even before.
Wow. Okay. Something you said in all of that, you said there was no expectation for better. Yeah. I wrote that down.
Yeah.
And how I, as a mom raising children with Down syndrome, when you apply, like we talk about assuming competence,
yeah.
like when we assume our kids and our loved ones with Down syndrome can, how that changes the outcome versus just like not believing. And I think we've come such a long way. Well, that's wild that you also said about if we applied this to people without Down syndrome, the medical or the life expectancy,
yeah.
we'd be well into like 300 years old. Yeah. I had never heard that or thought of it in those terms. And I, as a parent raising a child now, I think it's like now is the best time to have Down syndrome. In the history of having Down syndrome, it's now. Yeah. And there's a lot of work to be done.
There is.
And I'm not in the medical side at all. I could tell you from more like educational and just like how people with Down syndrome are perceived in general. We have a long way to go. So what are some of the things medically that you see need improvement?
I think one of the areas that is in dramatic need of improvement still is how we deliver the diagnosis to new families.
Okay.
Whether that be prenatally, whether that be postnatally, you know, before or after birth, essentially. So I think things like, you know, your podcast where you change the narrative, I think that is the key, is that medical providers need to know that people with Down syndrome, there is value that they are bringing into society that cannot be brought anywhere else and through anyone else. And so the unfortunate truth is that when families find out, including I'm sure many of your listeners, when they find out that their child has Down syndrome, it's almost always described as a negative interaction with that provider, whoever it was, a nurse, a doctor, a PA, a nurse practitioner, doesn't matter. And a genetic counselor, anybody, it's often a negative interaction. And what we need to do, and one of my passions in this area, but also just in general, whenever somebody asks me to talk about, it's how do we get people to get to know more people with Down syndrome and before they go into the medical field? For what we do here, for example, in Pittsburgh, is we take the medical students in their first week of medical school, before they ever take a single class, before they ever memorize a list of problems, quote unquote, that they can find in any genetic condition, we invite them to meet people. And so we bring in about 20, 25 families, anywhere ranging from babies all the way through adults with Down syndrome. And they just spend an afternoon just chit-chatting with medical students. And the impact that that has on the student in that first week of school, that 4 years later, many of the times these students will reach out to me on their graduation week and they'll say, we still remember that first week. We still remember meeting those families. And I think that is so important for us as medical people to be able to know what we're talking about before we walk in and talk to a family about your, and these are things that, oh my gosh, it's 2022, right? And people will still say to me, the doctor said to me, my child will never walk, never talk, and all these ridiculous statements. And I don't think the doctors are saying that out of just willful, you know, they're mean people. I just think that they're so uneducated when it comes to Down syndrome. And to me, that's a huge passion that I love to share with other people who do what I do.
Yeah. Yes. And amen.
Yes.
Our whole thing at the Lucky Few with the shifting narrative, it's like, you can't know what you don't know. It's one thing to know about Down syndrome. It is something entirely different to know a living, breathing person with Down syndrome. It's completely different experience. And we started with our nonprofit, our whole goal is to get as many stories about Down syndrome into the world so that people who don't have an opportunity to sit across from somebody and a real live breathing person can at least have some kind of access to as many different kinds of people with Down syndrome and those who love them as possible, because that relationship piece, it is the game changer, right? It is the game changer. So I share that passion with you and feel, I think in all facets for people with Down syndrome to have to have an equitable future and to have access and accessible future. In every facet, that relationship piece is so key.
So key. Yes. If anybody wants to know anything about Down syndrome, they can just come hang out at my brother's birthday party every year. It is a raucous and most, enjoyable experience for anyone. I would challenge anyone who spends time with my brother and his friends to not walk away saying, there's something that they bring that nobody else could.
Yep. Yeah. Yes. It's so good. I can't wait to talk about your brother, but his name is Doss, right?
Doss. Yep.
Oh, such a good name. Okay. We're going to get to Doss. But before we move on from this topic, I would love to hear some of your thoughts on how the guidelines have changed, because just this year, the guidelines for healthcare for individuals with Down syndrome given by the American Academy of Pediatrics changed this year. And it was a lot of people who love a person with Down syndrome working really hard to get those changes. Can you give us any insight on what this means for people with Down syndrome, what this means for practicing physicians and families getting a new diagnosis?
I think without a doubt, the biggest change is that the first, I think, 4 or 5 pages of the new guideline that just actually came out mid-April is the updated guideline, talks about how to give the diagnosis appropriately. And as I was saying earlier about that being one of my passions, it was beautiful to see that the American Academy of Pediatrics agrees that there's a big change that needs to come. So they outline exactly, this is what families have told us that we want when we receive a diagnosis, and this is what the provider should be doing. And I think that was a huge emphasis of this guideline. There were some other changes that came along, including remembering things medically that we need to follow, but also behaviorally. There's a bit more of a focus now for the first time ever in the guidelines on how to screen for things like autism. We know that autism happens at a little bit of a higher rate in people with Down syndrome, and it's often not recognized because many times providers may not realize that it can happen in someone with Down syndrome. If you're just a general pediatrician, you may not know that autism can happen and what it would look like in somebody with Down syndrome. So a whole section on diagnosing autism, ADHD, and those things are in these guidelines as well. Continued in the guidelines were things that were updated back in 2011, making sure we get sleep studies done because sleep apnea is so common, making sure that we know when to screen for thyroid and how to screen for anemia. And all of these things are in this guideline as well that were there to, again, guide the practitioners towards not missing things that are easily caught and easily treated if caught early enough. And so there's a great checklist in there for the providers to use as well. well. Now, many of your families may also be familiar with the American Academy of Pediatrics puts it out in a parent-friendly format as well, these guidelines. That's in the stages of being created right now. So what you might find is the parent-friendly guideline is actually based on the 2011 guideline, which is not wrong. In fact, they didn't remove anything from that guideline. But the additional guidelines that are in the new 2022 revision, that won't be in a parent-friendly version, probably for a few months is what I'm told.
Yeah. Okay. I might cut this part out of the podcast, but I have some questions for you about this too.
Yeah.
In terms of perception. Okay. I have been doing a bunch. Well, I think since Macy, my oldest daughter, who's 13, came into our lives, it became real apparent to me how she has to work twice as hard, 10 times as hard to be seen as half as much in our society, and how we need things to change, right? And there's this idea that I believe perception has to change before law can. Like, you look at civil rights movement, before any laws were put into place, perception had to change. Mm-hmm. And I think, and I'm so grateful for what the American Academy of Pediatrics has done and the people who have come and fought for that to make it happen, the families and people who love someone with Down syndrome. And I think that it is a good right step. I feel, and maybe I'm jaded, I feel hesitant to like celebrate big because it is a step and a step towards changing the perception of some, but the damage is already done. You know what I mean? Like, in terms of how my kids with Down syndrome are going to live and grow up, they are 13 and 8. But there is this sense of, what do we do now for our loved ones with Down syndrome who are living and breathing to continue to say, hey, we have to change this perception, right? This is great. What's happening. But the reality of that affecting your brother and my daughter and my son, it's pretty slim. It's pretty slim that it's going to better the way that they're perceived in the world. Yeah. And so I don't even know that there's a question there. That's just like food for thought. Like, what do you think about all I mean, that I just said?
I could not agree more with what you just said. I think that the burden, I hate to say it, but it is the burden of advocating has always seemed to fall onto the parents. Mm. And as a parent, you're, especially early on, many times you're navigating through the waters of figuring out what does Down syndrome mean for my child, in your own personal experience. To the idea of thinking about society as a whole probably doesn't fall in to the thought processes until much later on for somebody who has a new baby, especially with Down syndrome. I mean, you got to navigate the medical field and maybe there's some heart issues or whatever has to be dealt with. And then somebody later on will say, well, now it's your job to advocate for your child in these early years. It's your job to advocate for your child in the preschool and in the first grade. And when the school comes back to you and says, oh, they should continue to repeat these grades because they're never going to be good enough to get into second. Like, these things that you hear, it's maddening to me to think, how could I do that as a parent? Mm-hmm. And yet be thought that I have to be the only one advocating for my child. And so I agree with you. There's a role for larger organizations. And I think that's part of the role I think that a lot of the nationals try to take on in trying to advocate at Congress and Congress levels and national levels that way. That's the role that a lot of the Down syndrome associations have taken in the local areas to advocate. But in the end, boy, it is, you're right. It is really, really hard to change perceptions for that person at the grocery store that you run sure. into. Who says that horrible thing to you about, right. you know, and I don't know that there's an easy answer. I really don't. I think that for me, I feel like, can I make an impact with medical providers in a way that perhaps nobody else really could? I probably could because of the platform I've been given, the opportunities I've been given to be able to speak into these medical students' lives and things like that. But as a walking down the street, how am I going to change that person's perception? Mm-hmm. I don't have a great answer for you either. Like, that would change it right now. It's like mm-hmm. generational impacts that need to be made. I think we can just only hope to make our small indent and hopefully see bigger change down the road from it.
Yeah, I hear that. I receive that. And I would even say, like, to myself and to listeners who are raising kids with Down syndrome, that showing up piece is so important, right? Like, I think it is for me in thinking about like the bigger organizations and what they're doing, right? Like the Congress and things that are happening on the Hill and the legislation and all of that are so important
yeah.
and are making changes that for generations to come. I mean, it's going to be different and better, I think, living with Down syndrome because of what's happening. But again, how does that affect my kids? It doesn't necessarily right now. And that's okay. Now I'm backtracking to my own self pep talk here. And that the showing up piece is so huge, right? Like I even think about my daughter, Mason, who's 13, and we're in the throes of adolescence. And it's not just she has Down syndrome, adolescence, right? Like Jesus, take the wheel. That's what we're dealing with.
That's right.
But we get to show up in a space where she gets to be who she is. And I, as a parent, and what I want to encourage parents listening is, I have to check myself to make sure that I am having high expectations for my kids. Yeah. Or am I am walking into places expecting better for them.
Yeah.
And knowing that when people watch me do that, it's going to affect them, right? Like they're going to have to question their ways of thinking because of the way they see me as a mom interact with my kids who I fully embrace with Down syndrome. Yeah. And as they are with their intricacies within their diagnosis and as an individual with Down syndrome. So that was my little tangent on how we just to encouragement to parents or, you know, like keep on going.
Keep on doing it. And I think the small changes that you make in your circle make greater changes outside of that circle, right? And so anytime somebody says to you, yeah, I don't think that your child can do this because they have Down syndrome. Maybe it's a teacher. Maybe it's a doctor. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's, you know, someone else, a job coach. Somebody says, oh, they can't do this because they have Down syndrome. And you in your heart know that they haven't been given a chance. I say, just continue to fight for your loved one, because every change you make makes a change down the road that you don't even necessarily know, but that pebble mm-hmm. makes that ripple effect. And I think that would be my word of encouragement to families too.
Yeah, that's so good. Okay, and talking about ripple effects and keep on going, let's talk about DOS.
Yes.
Yay. Tell me again your age difference.
Yeah, we're about 20 months apart.
Okay, so
he's the old man. If he ever listens to this, I want him to know he's the old man.
You're much, much younger. I get that. Okay, so I am fascinated. I want to go back to when you gave your introduction about learning that he has Down syndrome when you were like 8, 9 years old. Yeah. Do you have other siblings? Is it the two of you?
Yeah. No, I have an older sibling. She's 7 years older than me. So about 5 years older than him. Yeah.
Okay. And did she have a similar experience to you in finding that out, or she just always knew?
No, she always knew. I think she was, you know, 5 years old when he was born. I think my parents kind of shared stuff with her differently than they did with me. I don't know why.
Yeah. Was Down syndrome then not like a topic in your house?
It wasn't a topic that would ever really come up. We just, as I was growing up, I remember there would be times where my mom or my dad would just say, hey, your brother needs a little extra help with that. Can you help him with it? Oh, yeah, sure. You know, I just figured older brothers need help with stuff sometimes. And that was just my understanding of the world at the time. Yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah.
It's such an interesting, it's just an interesting way to think about it. It's not right or wrong. It's just so different in that. Yeah. I mean, we've been talking about Down syndrome from the beginning, but also my oldest has Down syndrome. So it always has been a conversation in our home. It's an interesting idea. Okay. So then you guys are basically the same age. I know you're much, much younger, but it's like a similar, you're hitting, even if you didn't have Down syndrome, you're like people 20 months apart, you're hitting phases at a similar time and things like that.
Yeah.
So what are some things you can think about? Well, let's say this, you learn about Down syndrome. So then you're around that age. How does that change your relationship with him or your perspective of him, or does that change anything for you from then on?
Parents always, you know, when I meet with them, especially when they first learn of the diagnosis for their child, we'll talk about the shock of, you know, of discovering that their child has Down syndrome. And I think I had a shock of discovering that my brother had Down syndrome. But in a way, after that initial shock went by, I started to realize that my role in such a being his brother was different than any other brother, you know, brother relationship of any of my other friends, and in such a way that I can, even to this day, I can joke and laugh with my brother. I can try out my stand-up routines with him and not feel judgment, because he's going to laugh at my jokes and he's going to, you know, offer me his thoughts on things that I say or don't, and whether, you know, they hit home or they don't hit home. And he's just, he's taught me so much along the way of just a universal acceptance. I think that, boy, wouldn't our world be in a better place if people could just start to recognize that, yeah, they may not have the same belief as I do or the same thought process as I do, but yeah, you know what? They're probably pretty good on the inside. And I'll say, but Das, you know, that kid was mean to you, or that was, and he doesn't take it in the same way that I did. When I was growing up and trying to be his defender, quote unquote, he would often counsel me like, you don't need to do that. Like, I don't need you to jump on that kid and start trying to wail on him. That didn't bother me the way it bothered you. And then I just had to start to recognize that he lives a life without that encumbrance of needing to always, for every single slight, feel like he needs to react. And it's taught me a lot along the way about patience and about love. I experienced a lot more of the divine through him than I probably have through any other human that I've ever encountered. And so for me, as I talk about my brother, it's always been something where it's been a gradual process of me learning more. How can I be more like him than trying to make him more like me? I think, yes, a lot more often. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like that as a mom to my kids, for sure. What do you remember, or even talking with your parents about it, when the time, how old you guys were when you noticed a big shift? I'm making an assumption that there was a shift in, you are now maybe academically doing more, physically doing more. Do you have memories of that with him?
I do. And I have to, you know, to be completely transparent with you and your audience, I think the hardest part for me was when I got to be around 11 or 12, the other kids were staying for after school activities. My parents were both working, and they both worked as physicians. And so they were home late. And so somebody had to be home, because my sister was already off to college by then. Somebody had to be home to be there with my brother, get him in the house and do some of those after school activities with him. And so there were a lot of times where I wanted to do things and I couldn't. I wanted to be on the basketball team, or I wanted to be in the drama club, or whatever it was. And I was told, you know, you really can't, we need you here at home. And there was a lot of resentment initially when I was in those early adolescent ages. And then as I got into high school and the other kids were going, oh, no, you got to stay home. You know, we need you home for your brother, this. And a lot of that feeling of, I don't like this part of being a sibling. And I think that would be one bit of advice, I think, for families that I often give, and I'll give to your audience as well, is don't forget that sibling also has desires. The sibling who doesn't have Down syndrome also has desires and dreams that they want, and to not negate those, to try to find ways that you can incorporate their dreams and desires too, so that their life doesn't necessarily always need to revolve around their sibling. Now, on the other hand, the times where I also started to notice where I wanted to include my brother more were as I got into the age where I was graduating from high school. That was a big step, because me and him were like so close growing up, as you might imagine. And so he was older than I was, and yet was still completing high school in the extra 3 years that he was given, by the state to complete high school. I was already graduating and moving on to college, moving away for college. And that was really hard for him and really hard for me too. And then getting married, having children, these things that I started to do in my life that were really hard for him, because he wasn't experiencing those same things in his life. And so I started to have more compassion towards him in those moments than I probably had earlier on, trying to include him in those things. For example, when I first started dating this woman who would become my wife, I said to her, you're not marrying one, you're marrying two. You recognize that this is a package deal, that you know, when you marry into my family with me, you're also going to have to be a new sister to my brother. You're going to have to, you know, play this role that you may not recognize what it is until you get into it. And so there was a long courtship period while she was learning how to be a sister to my brother, because there's a lot involved in that. And she does it better than I am, I think, being a brother sometimes. And so I think there's a lot of that transition, like those big moments in life, where you start to recognize, one, your own needs as a sibling, but then also later on recognizing that your sibling's needs need to be met differently, perhaps, than perhaps another sibling who didn't have Down syndrome might have those needs. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing all that. I'm super curious if you can't speak for your parents, but your experience with your parents in those times. So like graduating high school, what was the, when you are and he's not, what are the conversations? You're going away to college, you're getting married, and even the thought of you you came to your own idea of this is a package deal. Yeah. And that's not the case for all siblings, which is fine, you know? Mm-hmm. But what were your parents' conversations with you in those moments and in those times?
Yeah, I think initially, if I was to ask, I think they would probably have said they were frustrated with me because I would try to rebel a lot from that. I don't want to say that I was an angel child. I was not. I would you know, desperately want to do these different things that would not include my brother. And they'd say, why don't you bring him with you? You're going out with your friends too. And I'm like, well, because it doesn't work the same when he's, you know, there with me, with my friends, when we're trying to do these things. And I think there was a lot of transitioning that they had to go through as well. And then on the other hand, as I got older, I think they also discovered that, you know, there's things ahead for me that my brother wouldn't necessarily be able to be a part of perfectly, like going to college and getting married and all those types of things. And I think as we've gotten older, I have now started to push more than my parents have to include him into things. So they live in Chicago. I live in Pittsburgh. I say, you know, my brother lives at home with my parents, but truly now that my parents are getting into their 80s, I think they would agree. He takes care of them more than they take care of him as they get older. And I think that, you know, there are times, especially each year before COVID and now as hopefully we're coming out of the pandemic phase, hopefully of COVID, we're able to bring him out to stay with us for a few weeks of each year. And I think that's beneficial for me. That's beneficial for him. That's beneficial for my wife. It's beneficial for my children because I've seen the impact that he's had on their life in ways that they would not have been able to experience. And so I think my parents are starting to recognize that it's okay for them to let go a little bit more of him and let him spend more time with my sister and spend more time with me without their presence. And I think they're starting to recognize they need to let go more. It's like, it's interesting the way life kind of takes you and the way that things have changed in all of our lives over the years.
Wow. That's so fascinating.
Yeah.
Okay. I have a couple more questions.
Yes.
And this, if the, you could talk about like, if you're talking to a patient or to a family and maybe from your own perspective, but as you're talking about your parents aging and your brother's home with them and then coming to visit you guys, when do you advise families put a plan into place and like best steps towards that in terms of care for making sure that your loved one with Down syndrome, family member with Down syndrome is cared for?
Yeah, I think the earliest as possible as that young person with Down syndrome is approaching into that teenage years, I think would be a definite time to really start to put things in place. There's some wonderful resources that are out there that can be used for that. The National Down Syndrome Congress has a family toolkit, it's called, which essentially just takes you section by section. It's a fill in the blank form. What are the medications that, you know, the person with Down syndrome takes? What are their daily routines? What is their favorite things to do for fun and things like that, that the current caregivers can fill out, oftentimes the parent, I would assume, for somebody who's a teenager. They start to fill that out and then they update it over the years. It's free on the NDSC website. You print it out again and you fill it out. For me, the greatest benefit of that toolkit was it opened up an opportunity to discuss things that are hard to talk about unless you have a toolkit in your hand to say, hey, I got to fill this out, Dad. Because nobody wants to think about their own mortality. Right. And certainly nobody wants to think about the time where they may not be able to take care of somebody that they wanted to take care of for the rest of their life. And so, so that toolkit's super, super helpful. So I would say, from my perspective, you know, 5 years old is too young. But as they get into the teenage years, it would be a really good time to start to think about a toolkit, because you never know when life may go in a particular direction where you may not be able to take care of that person with Down syndrome. So having this binder in place, maybe sitting on a shelf somewhere, could be really helpful.
Yeah, that's super helpful. We've had a guest on, Philip. He runs an organization called Enable.
Wonderful.
And it's a similar kind of process. And he has a sister with Down syndrome. So he kind of started it like, hey, this is something that we need to have in place for my sister.
Yeah.
And it's been super helpful. So those, I hadn't heard about that tool with the National Down Syndrome Congress. So we'll have a link to that here in our show notes for our listeners. That's great. Okay. We're going to get some good news in a minute, but two things before that. One last bit of advice for a parent who's listening and they're digging everything we're saying, but they are still, maybe they have a new diagnosis. They're still pretty terrified about the sibling aspect. They already have kids. and they just had a child with Down syndrome and they're feeling a little bit frazzled. What's like your big nugget that you give? Yeah.
Such a common question that we get. and it's one that I often have to turn my excitement level off, right?
Because, totally.
Because I know what the experience has been for me. And I know what the experience has been on national data that is, mm-hmm. that has shown very clearly that the level of positive impact is beyond anything you might imagine in terms of within the 90 to 95% of siblings will say, I would never want my sibling with Down syndrome anyone different than who they are. And I'm among those 95% that would say that. I can't imagine people saying that about their sibling who doesn't have Down syndrome, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I think my sister may one day listen to this. So I'll be careful what I say. But I don't think that people would say, she wouldn't say that about me. She, I know, would want things differently about me. So I think that that's something that I don't necessarily say at the newborn visit, right? But as the child gets older, as the parents ask that question, perhaps when there's a 3-year-old, 4-year-old patient in my office, I start to share a lot more about the fact that the positive impact for your other children in your family is actually beyond anything you might even be able to imagine. I go to the adult sibling conferences. And as I sit in these conferences, I don't tell anybody what I do necessarily. And they'll eventually get to the point where they say, well, what do people do in this room? And people will say, oh, I'm a nurse, or I'm a social worker, or I'm a teacher, or all these siblings in the room all seem to be doing something where they're helping other people, right? Including me as a doctor, helping other people. Why is that? Why is that in a room full of siblings of somebody with Down syndrome that we have this desire to be helpful to other people? And I think it's almost subconsciously, we inherit this desire to help other people as our siblings with Down syndrome have helped us and as we have helped them. And I think that's a dramatically positive thing. Now, there'll be one person in the room that will say something like, oh, I work in business. I make a lot of money for a lot of people. I don't see how that's helping anyone. And then they'll say, well, what do you do on the weekends? Well, I volunteer a lot at the soup kitchen down the street. Oh, interesting. Right. So it's almost like an innate thing. So I say that not to say 100%, right? It's always positive or whatever, but the vast majority of people, siblings, will experience something more positive than even the parent will experience. And I think that's a really amazing thing. And something that I definitely have experienced myself and have seen in other siblings that I take care of in our clinic.
Oh, that's so great. Yes. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
That is really, really beautiful. And so one of the things also that your brother helped you or like pushed you towards or encouraged you towards is your podcast.
Yes.
The last thing before we did get some good news about your brother.
Yeah.
Share with everybody a little bit more about your podcast because we didn't get a chance to touch on that much.
Yeah, it's the Down Syndrome Center podcast. So if you go to your podcast app and you search the word Down Syndrome, you'll find the lucky few. You'll find us. And then you'll find, I think, a couple of others that may not be updated quite as frequently, just because, I don't know, the parents are running them and maybe they don't get the chance to update them as frequently. So really, they're very easy. This podcast is very easy to find. We have about 130 or so podcasts that have been released now, and they cover any number of topics, almost everything we've kind of even discussed today, sibling relationships, medical care, toilet training, all of those things. If you're wondering about how do I do that for somebody with Down syndrome in my home or someone that you love, feel free, take a look at the podcast. You'll find any number of different topics that can help you in taking care of your young one or adult with Down syndrome, depending on how that may be. So my brother, of course, is the motivator for everything I do within medicine and anything I do with this podcast. So therefore, I have our podcast picture. You can easily identify it. It's me as a child getting a kiss from my brother on the forehead. And then split side, it's me giving him a kiss as an adult. And so I think that speaks volumes in terms of how I look at our relationship together, how much he thought I was giving to him as a young child and how much he gives to me now I recognize as an adult. So take a look at that podcast. They're free. Take a listen to them.
So good. It is such a gift. What you're sharing with the world. I know that I feel very grateful for all of it. And just, it's infectious. I feel like I'm just choking up like with joyful tears, just hearing
you
share and just seeing the work that you're doing with your life and then with the Down syndrome community. So as a parent in this space, I'm deeply grateful for all of your work. Thank you so much. Okay, we're going to wrap this up with some good news. We're going to take a quick break and then we'll be back with some good news about DOS. Guess what? I have a new children's book coming out August 9th. It is called Everyone Belongs, and it is a story about two sisters who create a show, and other people wonder, can they be a part of the show? And together they create a show where, you guessed it, everyone belongs. So it is available right this very moment for pre-order, and you can go anywhere you order books and pre-order it today. Every book pre-ordered helps in a huge way for the publishers to know if anyone's interested in this book. So if you're interested in this book, if you're excited to bring into your kids' life a book that teaches them that in fact everyone belongs, and you want that book in your kids' classrooms and all the spaces, go ahead and pre-order today. You can also go to heatheravis.com/everyonebelongs to learn more.
Time for good news, time for good news. Everybody, welcome to the good news. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, friends, we are back. Kishore, do you have some good news you want to share about your brother?
I have some great news. I shared earlier about how COVID had kind of taken our yearly visits away. You know, he would come and spend a few weeks with us each year ever since I moved to Pittsburgh back in 2005. Well, now that we're seeing a little bit of improvement, I should say, in the COVID situation, I noticed that Billy Joel is coming to Pittsburgh to do a concert in August. Now, my brother is a huge Billy Joel fan. And so I went ahead right away and bought tickets. And sure enough, he is going to be coming out and spending some time with us in August. We're going to go to the Billy Joel concert with my wife, who he still, to this day, after 20 years of marriage to my wife, Katie, he still calls her the new sister. So he is getting to go with the new sister. He has told me very clearly that he gets to sit next to her, and I'm on the outs, which is fine. So we're going to get to enjoy a Billy Joel concert together, which we're really excited about.
Oh, that is good news. I love that so much. Thank you for sharing that. I'm going to share real quick some good news from a listener. This is 321 Blessed Mom, who says, Jordan Grace has been reading all the classic books to me. It's amazing to see the transition from being small, a mother reading to her baby and her child, and then experiencing the books in their eyes through our child's sweet voice. It is simply magical. I don't take all the hard work for granted. She's so determined and tries hard. She reads The Lion King, Dumbo, 101 Dalmatians, Peter Pan, Lady and the Tramp, and we'll post her reading of The Little Mermaid next week. I'm assuming on their account, which is 321_blessed_mom on Instagram. And she says her reading brings us so much joy. Love that so much, Jordan Grace. Thank you for sharing that good news. All right, we're going to wrap up this episode. Thank you so, so much for joining us today, Dr. Velotti. We really appreciate all that you contribute to this episode and just to our community. So thank you. Okay.
Thank you for what you're doing. Your podcast is unbelievable. And the community you serve through your podcast as well. I just, moms come and talk to me all the time in the clinic about, oh, I just heard on The Lucky Few.
I love that.
That's so cool.
So cool. Well, I'm like, ideation is one of my strengths. So I'm just dreaming up so many ways that we're collaborating in the future. So I'll be in touch.
All right. I love it.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, as I said, that is a wrap. Thank you, Josh Avis, for editing this episode, and to Val Schleter for producing it. If you like what you heard, share it with family and friends. I'm sure you can think of all kinds of siblings who would benefit from this episode, and doctors and anyone, really. This is a great episode to be sharing. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts, and make sure you head to theluckyfewpodcast.com for show notes. We're going to have some good links in there for this episode. And if you're not already, follow us on social media at The Lucky Few Pod. You can leave your good news there. We would love to hear from you. Hey, listener, wherever you find yourself today, just know you are slaying it. So is your loved one with Down syndrome. If you have Down syndrome, you were basically born to slay it. We love all of you so much. We're here cheering you on. We can't wait to be together next week. See you then, or be together then.